Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. Erev Pesach, lots to do. Okay, today we're going to talk about the Pesach Seder from a very unusual perspective. We know that this coming Friday night, we will recite in our Haggadah, Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. We were slaves to the Pharaoh in Egypt. And on our ka'ara, we will have a symbol, the charoses. But the charoses seems like it's an ancillary symbol. It doesn't have a paragraph dedicated to it, and its meaning is somehow applied or understood, but we don't actually mention it by name. And it gets like a one-second little dip of the marar, of the korech, and it's not really seemingly a very prominent symbol in its meaning, but its implied meaning, I think, is very important. It represents this avdus, the slavery, and the nature of the slavery. What were we slaves for? We were builders. We were employed, well, we weren't employed, we were tasked to build the great building monuments of the Egyptian culture, and the degradation of our situation became, the text of the Torah tells us, and the Mefarshim tell us, so bad that we had to mix our own mortar. We had to create our own adobe mud bricks. And that's what the charoses represents. So, in celebration of our favorite topic, food, we are going to launch the next hour analysis of what was the slavery, where was the slavery, what did it mean, and does the building of Pisum and Ramses actually mean that the Jews created an architectural legacy or participated in an architectural legacy of ancient Egypt? What was our contribution? So let's go first right into text in Sefer Shemos Perek Beis, Parsha Shemos. And we're going to give a little context before we launch into slavery. I'll give you a few psukim that precede it. Vayakam melech hadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yadas Yosef. A new king arises who doesn't know Yosef. So the Mefarshim debate, a new king or a king with a new policy to forget the Jews, their contributions. Pasuk Tes. Vayomer elamo hinei am bnei Yisrael rav atzum imenu hava nischak malo pen yerbe v'haya ki sekrena melchama v'nosaf gam hu al soninu v'nalcham banu v'ala min ha'aretz. This Pharaoh calls his cabinet together and says, we have this Jewish problem. These people are becoming too numerous for us. Come, let us devise a solution. Hava nischak malo. Really, in a sense, let us devise a final solution. He was a totalitarian, he was a despot. And in many respects, this Paro was a murderer. Let's devise a solution. Why? What was his fear, at least expressed now? They will either gather against us in war themselves, the Jews, or they will join our enemies and gather against us. So, Pasuk Yud Aleph, the first piece of his idea to contain these Jews is Vayasimu alav sari mislaman anoso b'sivlosam Vayiven are miskenos lefaro es pisom v'es ramses. So we're now going to have an enslavement campaign where we're going to force the Jews to build these two cities, Pisum and Ramses. But v'kasher ya'anu aso ken yerbe v'chen yefrotz v'yakutzu mibnei Yisrael. However, despite this idea to enslave the Jews still multiplied, and the Jews therefore sickened, made them sick to their stomachs. Okay, so it should be noted that the text then goes on with the other ideas that they had. One of which was throw all the male babies into the Nile. Another one of which, as we'll analyze in the Ramban at the bottom of the page, was, first there was this sort of state slavery campaign of a massive building works project. But then it became personal slavery. Every Egyptian was entitled to take himself personal slaves. And to be frank, the text reveals some sort of, not ambivalence, but I guess an incoherence in this final solution. On the one hand, he didn't want them to rebel and to leave, these Jews and the Jewish problem, but on the other hand, he was murdering them. On the one hand, he was murdering only a part of them, the males, not the females. So in a sense, wanted to get rid of them, and in a sense, he wanted to keep them. So let's keep that ambivalence in mind. Let's go to Rashi, our first good go-to source, to define what were Pisum and Ramses. What was this slavery project that the Jews had to be a part of? Look at source number two, the last line of the Rashi, Es Pisum ve'es Ramses. Shelo hayu re'uyos mitchila lakach va'asa'um chazakos v'tziros la'otzar. So what does Rashi define Pisum and Ramses as? As two cities that were extant. They already existed. So we, the Jews, did not erect them from scratch, but rather we just fortified them and made them strong into fortress cities to be able to store all the treasures of this mighty pharaoh. Now, given what we know about ancient Egyptian civilization and architectural form, for instance, the pyramids, we know what feats of engineering their architecture was. We know that till today there are still, you know, mysteries of the pyramids that are unknown to us. We know that there are, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years of archaeological, you know, demystifying of what was in the pyramids, how they worked, the secret chambers. They keep, you know, trying to use more and more modern technology to discover these pathways, these secret, chambers and store places. They keep trying to figure out how they built them, how did they carry the stone, etc. So we know, therefore, that when a building project was undertaken by this ancient Egyptian civilization and the Jews participated in order to fortify these pre-existing cities, it must have involved quite the engineering marvels. And in fact, the Jews were part of that. And I'm sure that many lives were lost, as many slaves' lives are often lost in massive building works projects, in order to create these ingenious cities. Now, it should be noted that this is not the first time that the Torah tells us about the city of Ramses, okay? Look in Parshas Vayigash, in source number 3, back in Sefer Bereishis, Parshas Vayigash. In fact, we settled there. We were living there per Yosef's settling of us. In Perek Mem Zayin Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, Vayoshev Yosef es aviv es achav. This is when Yaakov and the brothers have joined him. Vayitim ham achuza be'eretz Mitzrayim b'mitav ha'aretz be'eretz Ramses. In fact, we lived in, I guess, Ramses district that was part of the larger Goshen district, ka'asher tziva paro. This is where Paro chose we should live. So this is not the first time that we meet the city of Ramses, and it's not the last time. Look at source number 4 in Parshas Beshalach when Bnei Yisrael, let's set the setting here. In Perek Yudalet Pasuk Beis, Bnei Yisrael have already passed Lel HaPesach, Makas Bechoros has already occurred, God has miraculously passed over the Jewish houses that have the blood symbol on the mashkof, on the doorpost, and the Jews have exited from their place of residence. However, they have not exited the land of Egypt yet, and they have not crossed the Yam Suf yet. So we're not at the crossing of the Red Sea, but we're near it. And where are they? Remember, this is the time when they were camping before they crossed over the river, and Paro gets confused because he thinks the Jews are confused. And there was some going forward and backward. He thinks the Jews have lost their way, and this is what spurs him on to now pursue them. And where are they camping? Look at Pasuk Beis. Source number 4, Daber al Bnei Yisrael v'yashuvu v'yachanu, so they're returning, this is the back and forth, v'yachanu, and encamp lefnei pi hachiros, bein migdal uvein hayam. So they're now between a place called Migdal, and they are right before the Yam Suf, lefnei baal tzifon nechol tachanu ahayam. Now, I should have put in here the Midrashim that actually identify pi hachiros as Ramses. And why? Because this was the city that had this gigantic natural formation, a huge rock that had split in two. So it was the mouth of these two rocks that formed this sort of channel through which the Jews exited. So what we have here, and the Medrash identifies this place as another name for Ramses. Now, what's fascinating about this concept of Ramses, therefore, is that there is some sort of symmetry. We started our sojourn 200 years prior in this Ramses region. We then lived there for the better part of our gullus. We did not move around within Egypt proper. And then, ultimately, becomes our final destination. It became the vehicle through which we exited. And the Mefarshim do a play on words. Pi hachiros milashon chiros. This became the channel of our freedom. So it was the site of our original sojourn. It became the site of our physical torture and our degradation, and then ultimately transformed itself into the jumping off point of freedom from Egypt. Now, let's talk about a little more Midrashic history of the place Ramses, or Pisum and Ramses. Look at source number 5. There is a very, very unusual medrash from the Yalkut Shimoni, from Sefer Iyov. And it identifies this place as follows. Okay, let's set the scene. Where are we up to in Tanakh? When Yosef has not revealed his identity yet to the brothers, and he demands that they bring down this younger brother that they revealed existed, Binyamin, and then he plants his goblet in Binyamin's sack so that he could falsely accuse him, so that he could basically retain Binyamin as his slave. This is the setting. Okay, what happens? Miyad, look at source 5, Ka'at Yehuda v'sha'ag b'kol gadol. Yehuda became so enraged and so furious, he lets out this roar. V'holech kolo, arba me'os parsa ad sheshama chushim ben dan. It traveled so far, the sound of this roar, that back in Canaan, his nephew Chushim heard the roar, v'kafatz uba me'eretz Canaan uba etzel Yehuda, and he heard that his uncle Yehuda was in distress, and he ran all the way. Remember, Chushim was the fast runner. He ran all the way to help his brother, his uncle Yehuda. V'sha'agu shnehem uvakasha eretz Mitzrayim lahafuch aleihem. And he joined Yehuda in this tremendous roar, and as a result, they caused somewhat of an earthquake. They totally disturbed the lands of Egypt. Jump down to the bottom bold text. Kesheba chushim ben dan etel Yehuda sha'agu shnehem umikolam naflu shtei ayaros gedolosha b'Mitzrayim Pisom v'Ramses. And as a result of this little earthquake that they caused, what comes tumbling down into pieces? These two cities, Pisom v'Ramses. V'al davar zeh nigzar al Yisrael livnosam sheneemar vayiven arei miskenos. Okay, so the midrashic form here is mida keneged mida, measure for measure. Your ancestors destroyed our cities through their wrath and their rage, their unbridled rage, and therefore it's no mistake that the Pharaoh and the collective imagination and memory of the Egyptian people is still vengeful. These many years later, when the Jews become slaves at this new policy of this new king, allegedly, who did not know Yosef, he is now going to punish them for it. You have to rebuild what your ancestors destroyed. Now, let's talk about the Ramban for a minute. The Ramban has a very interesting analysis of the degradation, the slow degradation into slavery. This is a little bit of a tangent, but it's quite fascinating, so let's read it together. Source number 6. Sari misim laman anoso. Sam al ha'amas lakachas mehem anashim la'avodas ha'melech. Umina ahamas sarim min hamitzrim sheikhu mehem kirtzonam anashim lefi ha'avoda. They collected this tax in order to launch these great building projects. And part of the tax was actually a draft. Ramban doesn't say it was a draft. Other historical scholars actually say at first it was voluntary. Other midrashim say at first it was voluntary, and even Egyptians volunteered for this mass building project. The Ramban seems to indicate here that no, it was a forced labor. So it was either a draft or it was forced labor. But how did the forced labor work? Let's go back in, line 2. Lefi ha'avoda chalifos, chodesh o yoter yiyu bebinyan hamelech. How did this work? It was in month-long shifts. They would be in the service of the king, the building project service of the king, right? Usha'ar yamim bebeso, and the rest of his days, he would be able to go back home to his family. The hasarim eile tzavu osam sheyivnu arim lafaro, and their task was to build these cities for Paro. Vayiven am ha'am arim misknos lafaro b'mas hazeh. How did they fund this building works project? Through this newly collected tax. V'kasher ra'u shalo yazik la Yazik Zelaam Katsu Bachayehem. So this was a way of breaking the Jews. One of the Midrashim says that actually it was a ruse. First, the Pharaoh declared that everyone must join. It was a forced draft. But slowly but surely, all the Egyptians peeled off one by one, and only the Jews were left. And in fact, later in this Ramban, it says that they were paid. There were rations, there were food that was provided to them. We'll read that in a minute. But then ultimately the pay was taken away. And this ruse was in order to break the Jews and to slowly but surely get them into this slave labor. Okay, and then we see, go down to the fifth line, 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth line. This line starts, b'chayehem ipneihem. They became sick from them because they weren't being broken. Their spirit wasn't being broken and their numbers weren't being diminished. So, what's the next stage in the slavery campaign? V'gazru she'ya'avidu kol mitzrayim asa'am, v'chol ish mitzri she'yitzterech ba'avodah yimshol lakhos mehem anashim she'ya'asu avodaso. So, as I mentioned above, really it started as state-sponsored slavery, but then it became personal slavery. This was phase 2 in the degradation of the Jews' situation. Now, any man was able to enslave any other man. Fascinatingly, there's really no source that points out, even historically and archaeologically, like in Egyptology, that the women were enslaved. It's only the men who were enslaved. There is one medrash that talks about the switching of the labor, the men were forced to do women's jobs and the women were forced to do men's jobs, but it doesn't bear out necessarily in the historical text. And this is why I said before that there was this ambivalent, you know, final solution for what to do with the Jewish problem. It was a strange solution that had its many, you know, permutations. It had many phases and many styles, so to speak. They kept trying to figure out, what are we going to do with the Jews? Okay. Now go down into the middle of the paragraph. This is important. The word starts, mitchila, Hayu hasarim notnim lahem halavinim. And in the beginning, they actually were provided with the bricks. V'hayu anshe hamas bonim habinyan. This draft labor force was actually building, they were just the builders. V'ata nahagu ha'am ba'avoda v'tzivam sheyihiyu meviim afar v'osim hachomer b'yedeim uviragleihim. V'lo yinetein lahem mibes hamelech rak hateven belvad. Okay, part of the degradation of the Jews, at first they were provided with all building materials and building supplies, but then slowly but surely, all of these things were withdrawn from them. They were left with straw alone. And they were only, and they were told, you have to produce your own mud bricks. So they had to go get the mud, which was degrading to walk through the mud. And you have to create your own bricks. We're only giving you straw. Fascinatingly, this Ramban, obviously the Ramban did his research like I did research for this. I went to read some archaeological sources and some Egyptian history sources at the Columbia Library. And the Ramban apparently also, he knew some scholars who were informing him and teaching him about the shifts. This bears out in historical texts. There were shifts of slaves. And what the history says, though, which aligns and might be a reference to this by the Ramban, is that you know that the Nile overflows. And as a result, it creates all this mud and sludge when it's, you know, withdrawn, moistens the land. So there was a very complex engineering system of ditches and dams in Egypt to capture, you know, to separate the water from the fertile land itself, and all the ditches would fill up regularly with mud. So this could align with this kind of slavery, that the Jews were actually forced to travel through these ditches barefoot in order to retain mud, in order to obtain mud, in order to build their bricks. So this is a fascinating reference to what could have really been going on. Okay. And then, just the second to last line, I wanted to point out the source, V'haya ha-melech mefarnes osam, it's one word in from Befarach, V'haya ha-melech mefarnes osam belechem tzar, kemin haglafolei ha-melech. So what does that mean? At first, the king was actually supporting them, belechem tzar, meaning stingy bread, or meaning rations. They were paid with food. And then he goes on to point out that later on, in Sefer Bamidbar, look at the next line, V'ze ma'amar ha-mit'avim. Remember in Bamidbar, the complainers of the amongst the Jews say, She'amru zacharnu es ha-daga asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam es ha-kishuim. This is in Bamidbar Yud Aleph. Why? How did they remember the fish and the watermelons and the cucumber and the onions? Because they were fed. They were fed all these things, and there were a lot of fish, and there was food in abundance in this particular area. So they were fed this food, and when they get to the desert and they have to eat mud, it's rather a disappointment because they're used to having a proper diet. It might be meager, but they had food, and they had lots of types of food. They had a menu. That was the problem with the mud. Wasn't a big enough menu selection for them. Okay, and now let's go to source number 7, which is the final midrash I'd like to share with you on Pisum and Ramses. And actually, this was my starting point. When I was a child, I learned this midrash, and I never forgot it. It always stayed with me, because there was something about it that bothered me. Let's read it together, and then you'll see for yourselves. Incidentally, it appears in the Yalkut Shmoni, in the Medrash Rabbah, and in the Gemara Sota, Yud Aleph Aleph, Amud Aleph. But I just printed right here the Yalkut Shmoni source. So unfortunately, the text that we'll start with is not in bold, but if you count up from the fourth line from the bottom, the sentence starts with the word Shemim Maskenos, and go to the middle of the paragraph and you'll see Es Pisum ve Es Ramses. Okay. This is in the middle of a conversation in the Gemara between Rav and Shmuel. Chad Amar Pisum, Shmuel. One of them, Rav, says that this was one and the same city. They were not two cities. They were one city, and its name was Pisum. V'lama nekra shemo Ramses. But why did they call it Ramses? Sherishon rishon misroses. Because slowly but surely, it was crumbling. So in other words, Ramses was the nickname for the city, Pisum, because everything they built was sort of lost almost immediately. It was not a stable city. V'chad amar Ramses shemo, and Shmuel says, nope, its actual name was Ramses. V'lama nekra shemo Pisum, so why would they have the nickname Pisum? Sherishon rishon pi tahom bla'o. Because slowly but surely, it was sinking into the mouth of hell, okay? It was sinking down. Look at the Malbim for some amplification and explanation of what this means, okay? At the count three lines up from the bottom, and go to the middle of the sentence. After the word ba'otzros, you have the chazal. The chazal amru, shepisum v'ramses, Moreh shebanu habinyanim al makom lach v'nerfash. What does this mean, Pisum and Ramses? What are chazal, the chad v'chad above in the Gemara, the Rav and Shmuel? What does it mean? It means that they built on moist ground. Some interpreted it as quicksand. That it was impossible, shelo yachlu lahamid sham yesod chazak. It was impossible to build a strong foundation because the land itself was so destabilized from all of the mud. The rishon rishon misroses upitahom blo'o. Okay, now, the Malbim is going to try to give an explanation. What could possibly be the use of employing this, you know, 500,000 strong, right? We have a census when we get to the desert. There are 600,000 males between the age of 20 and whatever, 70? You know, so 60? So 50? Okay. So there are 600,000 able-bodied men, right? What in the world could possibly be the use value of taking 600,000 able-bodied slaves and making them build nothing for you? Why would they do this? So the Malbim goes psychologist on us, and he attempts an explanation. Ki lo haya kavanaso habinyan atzmo. They really had no intention for the building projects themselves. They didn't care about the buildings. Rak lahalos es habonim shelo yigmar habinyan laolam kidei sheyu meunim tamid. This was part of the psychological torture. The campaign was psychological, not just physical. And the psychological torture of constantly laboring for however long they were actually slaves in Egypt was the torture of utter futility, of meaninglessness. And, it's a terrible thing. You want to at least know that you accomplished something, that you did something great. And, in fact, you know, many Jews around the world certainly believe, oh yes, we Jews, when we were slaves in Egypt, we built those pyramids. Now, we'll talk about those pyramids in a minute. Spoiler alert, we didn't build those pyramids, okay? We built Pisum and Ramses. And according to this Medrash, Gemara, and according to the Malbim, it was all an exercise in elaborate psychological torture. So, even as a child, and certainly now as an adult, and certainly now I am an architect, and every person in this room, non-architects included, we have questions about this. And what's the first question that we have? Okay, so let's go back to those pyramids that we all know about. And let's go back to this ancient Egyptian civilization that we all know about. And let's all go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art Egyptian Wing, which I just revisited just last Sunday as a little refresher for this shiur, okay? What do we know about the pharaohs, the mighty pharaohs of Egypt? They were obsessed with building. They were obsessed with their monuments. They were obsessed with two types of buildings. They were obsessed, on the one hand, with temple building for the here and now, for the many idols and gods, and they were obsessed with funerary monuments, building for eternity. The pyramids are buildings for eternity, and in fact, so far, so good. Still in great condition, still going, right? Built thousands of years ago. So, what bothers all of us, therefore, of necessity is, this is not logical. Logic does not compute. Why would they waste this labor force? They were obsessed with building. And those pyramids that we didn't build, who were they built by? Actually, recent history has discovered, more recent history, that in fact those were not built by slaves per se who were degraded, but they were built by a paid guild of sophisticated builders. Now, they probably had in their employ slaves who did die in the process, and there are probably lots of dead bodies in there because they closed up certain chambers, but in order to hold up the rocks and the walls, there had to be people inside to help, you know, the closing of the chambers, okay? So, in other words, you know, a culture that was obsessed with building really actually at certain points in its history and for certain types of structure were using paid, you know, craftsmen, skilled craftsmen. They weren't just squandering labor. And therefore, it seems like this doesn't work. And basically, what we therefore have to do, at least for now, is shelve this Gemara into the category of, it's not that Chas v'Shalom Rav and Shmuel, you know, they didn't get it or they made a mistake. It's that really they're just playing and they're making a point, a larger moralistic point. That's how I put this Gemara into context for many years for myself. Okay. Then I told you that I went to the Columbia University Library and I started looking at archaeology sources and I started looking at historical sources and I put into the computer search engine Pisum and Ramses. I don't know how to spell it, I don't know what it's called in Egyptian or in scholarly language, but I find it, I get there, and something very, very fascinating starts to emerge. Number one, okay, there's a whole battery of some historical scholars who dismiss this of hand. Sheer myth. Legacy telling, myth telling, storytelling. There were no such cities, Pisum and Ramses. The Bible is full of all these bogomises, right? It doesn't exist. And why? Because we have no archaeological evidence that proves that they exist. What were Pisum? What were Ramses? That is what is one layer, one strata of historical scholarly data. Right? We need the data. We need the proof. But then you start scratching beneath the surface, and actually when you go into the discipline, not of history, but into the discipline of archaeology, you have much greater open-mindedness to the possibility that these places existed. Why? What are archaeologists, essentially? They're just like scholarly treasure hunters, right? And a treasure hunter always needs a map. Or a story, or a book to follow. So archaeologists as a discipline never dismiss the Bible. This is their roadmap. This is what they're going to use to go dig. They're not dismissing it. They're trying to validate it, not because they believe in God and their Yarei Shemayim like we are, but because they want to discover. They want to be the ones to discover these lost treasures. And, in fact, as it turns out, there's a fascinating literature about what Pisum and Ramses could possibly be. So number one, chronologically, let's place this in time. The Jews, scholarly opinion has concluded, probably were slaves in Egypt in the 13th century BCE at the time of the 19th Egyptian dynasty that was headed up by a man named Ramses, Ramses II. And therefore, when he builds Ramses, it becomes his city. Ramses is not a Hebrew word. And therefore, what does he do? He's obviously not building it because it pre-existed him at least by many generations, right? Rashi tells us they just fortified these cities. He is now remaking this city, Ramses, into a magnificent capital for his empire. And it's also very interesting that he does this politically and he does this theologically. His political reasons are he differentiates himself from prior pharaohs, okay? And he does this, and like other pharaohs, he is establishing his own architectural legacy through a massive building project. And he builds two cities, according to this data, one called Ramses, his capital, and one called Pitom, or Peratum in Egyptian, for his new god, the god Atum. Per Atum is a religious city for his new idol. And what is he doing? He's sort of trumping the prior emperors. I don't believe in your gods, and I'm not building for your gods. I don't need your capitals, I'm building my own capitals. And of the Egyptian dynasties, this one seems to be the one that launched the greatest of all the building campaigns in Egyptian history. Now, I would like to just read to you from the book Exploring Exodus by Professor Nachum Sarna, who gives a synopsis of those archaeological sources, and he describes, I'm sorry, I don't have it on the source sheet, so I'll just read it to you out loud. He describes these cities, what Ramses was. Okay. Its beauty and glory were extolled in poems that have survived to this day. And so what I did was I went to look up some of those poems, those Egyptian poems about the beauty and glory of Pisum and Ramses. One such describes it as being full of food and provisions. The sun rises in its horizon and sets within it. All men have left their towns and settled in its territory. Ah, That aligns with the new king, the new policy, the new attitude to rebuild Pisum and Ramses. That aligns with the state's project, building works project. Come and settle in this place. We're going to build it. We're going to make it magnificent. The castle which is in it is the horizon of heaven. Another text supports it to be in very good condition, a beautiful district without its like after the pattern of Thebes. Ramses moved the center of the empire from Thebes, which was more central Egypt, to Ramses, to his city, which is in the northern part of Egypt, and it's actually in the Nile Delta area. So it's northeast in Egypt, and in fact, it's on the border right near Sinai, like right at the northeasternmost border of Egypt. Okay. A beautiful district without its like after the pattern of Thebes. The residence is pleasant in life. Its field is full of everything good. It's full of supplies and food every day. Its ponds with fish. Its lakes with birds. Its meadows are verdant with grass. Its banks bear dates, melons, abundant on the sands. Its granaries are so full of barley and emmer that they come near to the sky. So building otzros, right? We were making them fortified to capture all of these, you know, supplies. Onions and leeks are for food, the lettuce of the garden, pomegranates, apples, olive, figs. It goes on and on and on. Okay. Additionally, it describes Ramses II as the pharaoh who, Ramses II describes Ramses II as the pharaoh who achieved an unrivaled reputation as a vigorous builder on a prodigious scale. Monumental structures, numerous obelisks, colossal statues of himself, magnificent palaces and temples adorned the lands of Egypt, especially the Delta. Okay, in just his 66-year rule, he only ruled for 66 years. So what does all of this do? It further, you know, makes us question that Gemara beforehand that says, oh, it was all for naught. Yeah, he took 600,000 men and he just tortured them psychologically. It doesn't compute. And yet, I continue to read the sources and it says, and yet, we have no proof of this magnificent capital of Ramses II. Why? And archaeologists then plumb the depths of this mystery. The first answer is what we just described, the Nile Delta, the geographic location. What does the Nile do? It rises, it floods, and it destroys. All the architecture from that time is buried under, you know, thousands of meters worth of mud and sand. They once found something from the early 20th century, the 1900s, in the Sinai Desert. They found some sort of vehicle that was buried under 3 meters of mud. Okay, so that's from, 100 years ago? So if this is from thousands and thousands of years ago, you can well imagine how deep you would have to dig in order to find this. So, and it should be noted, incidentally, that what the Egyptians did as a building strategy is, since the Nile overflows to the east and not to the west, they built all of their temples, which celebrated the here and now and the everyday, on the eastern side of the Nile, and they built all of their pyramids and their funerary architecture on the western side of the Nile, because that remained dry, and that would never be flooded over, and that would never disappear in any of the Niles spilling over. So the Egyptians themselves knew full well what this territory was like, what this ground was like. They weren't making the Jews build on quicksand. They weren't aiming to build on quicksand. They were aiming for eternity. They were aiming to memorialize themselves through their buildings. But they also knew that the temples, which incidentally were built with columns were not just a strategy for holding up the beams. They were a strategy to let the water flow through. Okay? So the temples had these sort of, you know, pervious sources, like a building strategy that allowed the water to penetrate. Whereas the pyramids were built solid on the ground because no water ever touched them. They're in a desert, they remain dry. So architecturally, this computes. Incidentally, Ramses II was not the only emperor who was obsessed with his own glory and building legacy. Ramses was followed up by many, many later emperors, pharaohs, who themselves wanted to build big. And a common custom amongst the pharaohs was to show their greater power than the prior pharaoh was to destroy the monuments of earlier predecessors. So just like Ramses established his capital city in a city dedicated to himself, and by the way, you could wonder, so why was it called Ramses? Because he was Ramses II. There could have been a Ramses I, like an Elizabeth I, a George I, a Henry VIII. There were multiple Ramses. It was an Egyptian pharaonic name. Okay, so later generations of leaders, of pharaohs, are going to do the same thing. They're going to destroy, they're going to relocate their capitals, and they're going to destroy prior structures, and they're going to use the stones that were used and the bricks that were used in prior building projects to build their own building projects. So this was common in Egyptian history. So, number one, we've solved the geographic location. We've solved the mention of the quicksands, okay, the wet soil. Number two, we've solved the mystery of why isn't there evidence of this. They probably were destroyed over time naturally, or they were destroyed by other men who launched their own building campaigns. And finally, let's just have a word about history itself. The custom of history writing, or the history of history, is as an objective record of exactly what happens along the way in chronological order is a fairly modern thing. And some people will dispute that even today there's no objective history writing. It's always written from a certain perspective, from your country's perspective, from the writer's perspective. But certainly in ancient Egypt, as much hieroglyphs as they had, and as much as they were obsessed with recording themselves and writing things, certainly their histories, so to speak, were not recording how a rebellious slave nation defeated them. It was the custom of the time to only record their victories, not their failures. So the fact that nothing refers to the Jews there, and the fact that there is no historical evidence, either written or physical, it's all starting to fall in place. And therefore, we have to return to our Gemara. We have to return to at least my initial feeling about this Gemara as, okay, it's a nice idea, it's a moralistic concept. And we have to now revisit our attitude toward that Gemara 100% lehefech. You think that I'm the only one who did my research? You think that I'm the only one who knows how to go to Columbia Library? I think that those Chad v'Chad, Rav u'Shmuel, they were clever guys, okay? They did their research. They knew plenty, okay? They were being clever, just like they're playing with the words. They know that Ramses is not a Jewish word. That's not a Hebrew word. They know it's an Egyptian word. But they're doing some sort of, you know, silly wordplay here. Rishon, Rishon, Misrose. Slowly but surely, it crumbled. They're using Hebrew words to play with an Egyptian name. What is this, by accident? They're not naive. They're doing this on purpose. This is their clever commentary on how, you know what, those Egyptians, they tortured us through that slavery to build their massive building monuments, but guess what? It's all gone. It doesn't exist, and we're here to just sit in our Beis Medrash and kind of make fun of it. It sunk, it went away, it got destroyed, it's all gone. So what? They are vanquished, and we are here to tell the story. Okay. Now, time check. Okay. So, now, one last thing of those pyramids. Okay. The pyramids were actually built hundreds of years before the Jews got to Egypt. In fact, they were built during the time of the Avos. So, therefore, you know that phenomenon of the Israelis who get on the tourist bus and they drive through Sinai and they go to Egypt to see the pyramids, like that whole thing of like Israeli tourists in Egypt, and then, God forbid, there's an incident, we're all wondering, like, what were they thinking? Like, why did they do that? Like, why did they go on the buses? So, by the way, those first Israeli tourists who were looking at the pyramids were probably Abraham and Sarah, because the pyramids existed during their time. And it's very fascinating to keep that in mind in our own conception of our own history, which is, of course, there was phenomenal architecture while the Jews were living in Egypt. They built Pisa and Ramses in the shadow of and with the full knowledge of those pyramids. Okay? So we didn't actually build them, but we knew of them and we participated in the building of these great artifacts. And I'm not really joking when I say go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and see the Egyptian wing. Go and see what we participated in. And this, in a sense, is our architectural legacy. In a sense, it's there, and in a sense, it's disappeared. So it's there, but somehow it has sunken away. So do we have an architectural legacy? Yes, we do. But it's a complicated architectural legacy because it stands no longer. With that in mind, let's conclude our discussion with a section that I call Jewish values. Okay? What are the Jewish values instead of an architectural legacy that stands in its great glory? Okay, still on the bottom of the second page, don't turn the page yet. We have a pasuk that is the very next inyan after this inyan of the Jews and the peace on Ramses, and then it goes on to talk about how the individual Mitzi started to enslave us, and then it goes on to talk about the issue with the bricks, and we didn't have enough, and we had to build our own, blah, blah, blah. So the whole building story sort of just stops. We switch topics, and the next inyan is the following. Source number 11, Shemos, Perak Aleph, Pasuk Tesvav. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim Lamialdos Ha'ivrios, Asher Shem Ha'achas Shifra V'Shem Hashenes Pua. The next topic is the Mialdos saving the Jewish babies. So, this is actually a really fascinating point, which Professor Sarna makes in this book that I'm reading to you from, the Exploring Exodus book, The Origins of Biblical Israel. He points out a fascinating idea with regard to the Smichos Inyanim, this unusual connecting of these two stories, the brick building, city building, and the Mialdos, the saving of Jewish lives. What is remarkable, he points out in source number 12, is that the names of these lowly women are recorded, whereas by contrast, the all-powerful reigning monarch is consistently veiled in anonymity. In this way, the biblical narrator expresses his scale of values. All the power of the mighty Pharaoh, the outward magnificence of his realm, the dazzling splendor of his court, his colossal monuments, are all illusory, ephemeral, and in the ultimate reckoning, insignificant, and they must crumble into dust because they rest on foundations of empty of moral contents. So what does Professor Sarna do here for us? He says, isn't it fascinating that these lowly midwives are named names, they're given names, Shifra and Pua. But the Pharaoh is never, we're never told who he is. Later on in Nevi'im, we have a Paro Necho, we have a named Pharaoh. But this Pharaoh, I just told you, history tells us it was Ramses II. There's sort of this backwards, they built Are Miskinos, Pison Ramses. There's no identifying him as Paro, Pharaoh Ramses. What does Pharaoh, the Egyptian word, mean? It's a metonym, which my family and I just discussed the definition of the word metonym. It stands in for something else. It's like saying the White House, or the palace, or the crown. It's a nameless person. You might know who's reigning at the time, but it doesn't actually refer to a particular person. There were many, many, many pharaohs. There were many pharaonic dynasties. And this guy doesn't get names at all. It's a slap. It's an insult. And also, it's the Torah text's way of doing exactly what we just said the Gemara did. It's a way of saying, ha, ha. You think that you lasted? You think that you etched your name in stone? He did etch his name in many, many thousands of stones, exactly, right? But it doesn't matter, because in the end, what really matters are Jewish values. We matter. And what are our Jewish values? That we survived. that we survive this degradation of slavery in Egypt, that we survive every generation, Shebechol Darvadar, right? They stand up against us, they want to destroy us, but here we are, still to tell the story. What's the Torah scale of values? The Torah scale of values is that we celebrate with names, Shefram Puah. That's who gets named. They get named. They get mentioned in the Torah. But the Pharaoh and all those mighty structures, they barely get mentioned. I would like to look at source number 13 for an interesting combination of these two ideas. This is a Yalkut Shimoni in Parashas Beshalach. Unfortunately, it's not the version of the Medrash. You know, there are many versions of Midrashim. They're repeated from source to source. This is what we found, but I'm going to tell it to you also in the version I want to. Okay. The setting is that Bnei Yisrael finally do come to the Yamsuf, and they are crossing. And we know full well that behind them are bearing down, who? The Mitzrayim. And they're in their markavos, they have their susim, they're in their chariots, they have their horses, and they're bearing down on the Jews. And there's sort of this mayhem and this panic, and I actually once gave a shiur on that moment of panic. I don't know if you remember it. It was an hour-long exposition just on that moment of what happened right before crossing the sea. And what happens is that the Jews finally get into the sea, and it parts for them. And then suddenly, this Medrash is going to elucidate, is going to come to elucidate what is happening in Shamayim parallel to this exodus, okay, to this final crossing, the last leg to freedom. There's a whole debate in Shamayim. And the angel that protects the Egyptians comes before God and pleads mercy. God, please don't let them drown. I'll let the Jews go, but don't let the people drown. And Gavriel, the angel Gavriel, who is the angel of justice, he appears and pitches his case. And what does he do? Look at the bolded text. Ba'osa sha'a amad Gavriel v'lakach melabin shel tit v'amad lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Gavriel comes with props in order to make his case before God. What is he holding? One of these bricks that we were forced to make in Egypt. Now, the version of the Medrash that I really wanted to quote was that the brick had embedded within it a skeleton of a Jewish baby, of a dead Jewish baby. Because we know, as I told you, there were many permutations to this solution to get rid of the Jews, one of which was throw the male babies into the Nile River. So Gavriel sort of summarizes the degradation of the entire process. First, we were forced to build. Then we were forced to create our own bricks. Then we were murdered in the process. Then our children were murdered in the process. Look at this horrendous artifact of this massive building project, a Jewish skeleton embedded in a very brick that was used to build up the glory of ancient Egypt. Va'amad lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu va'amar, Ribono shel olam, halo shibdu banayach shibud kasheh kazeh. Didn't they suffer enough? Wasn't the shibud hard enough? Terachim aleihem miyad, terachim aleihem, have mercy on them. Miyad chazar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, vayashev aleihem b'midas hadin. What does God do immediately? He makes all of the water return over, engulf the Egyptians. And some other midrashim say that the reference here, melabin shaltit, a mud brick, he turned the water into mud so that their horses and their wheels couldn't move in the mud, they couldn't cross, and ultimately they died. So we have this long arc of justice that is fulfilled here. You enslaved us with mud. You forced us to go be the cleaners of the ditches of the Nile. You forced us to create our own mud bricks. You gave us nothing. You killed us in the process. And now you yourselves will die through the vehicle by which you tortured us. Let us conclude by looking at this image of the Stele of Merneptah that I've included in source number 14. The Stele of Merneptah is a stone that is erected in the Cairo Museum, and it is very important to archaeology and to this discussion and this topic because it is actually the only written evidence that mentions Israel and the existence of Israel at all in a relationship with the Egyptians. It doesn't say they lived there, but the line that is contained, and no, I don't read hieroglyphs, so I can't tell you what line to count up to, but the line that is contained within there reads as follows: Israel is vanquished. And when this stele was discovered by the archaeological community, the whole biblical community, the whole Jewish community, was celebrating. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is from that time, the time of Ramses, or the dynasty of Ramses. There were a few kings within his dynasty, within his immediate family line. And it's mentioning Israel. This is proof. This is proof that we were there. But listen to the irony. The irony is that it's saying we were there, but we're gone. Israel is vanquished. Okay? So my curatorial instinct is I would love to be invited by the Cairo Museum to come and direct a Passover special exhibition. And my Passover special will be right next to the Stele of Merneptah. What will we have? We're going to have an image. We're going to have a little shtender, and the shtender is going to have put on top of it a Haggadah. Because you know what? We don't have steles. We don't have monuments. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We really have no architectural monuments to record our stay, our sojourn in Egypt, or even to record our greatness of what once was in Israel. We are not people who are necessarily great architects and builders. And yes, that's a humbling statement coming from me, and it's something I have to know. What is the Jewish scale of values? We have life, and we have survived. The Haggadah in conjunction with the Stele of Merneptah proves we have our books, we have our Torah, we have our stories, and of course we have charoses, we have our food because we're Jews, and this is what commemorates our story. We don't need the bricks, we see the symbol of the bricks that once were, and it doesn't matter that we don't have the bricks or the buildings or the monuments, because we have the Haggadah that instead not only communicates that Israel is not vanquished, but tells the story of the triumph of our survival. Thank you.